What's good, listeners? Welcome to the Chris Collins Show, Millennial Talk Show. Good morning, Marissa. How's it going, fam?
Oh my gosh, it is fabulous.
Yes, it's a beautiful day.
I cannot wait for this weekend. I get to hang out with my family. It's Easter.
Right.
I get to look for Easter eggs. Yes, very excited.
Yeah, I just feel like the vibes are immaculate right now. And I know I was kind of confused this morning. I don't know about you, Marissa, but like everybody's kind of celebrating Star Wars today. It's not even May 4th.
That's what you're saying. I know. I feel like that's when, you know, when Christmas is celebrated before Halloween.
Yes, that's what I feel like happening. But yeah, there's all this like really early announcements. I'm kind of surprised why it's coming, you know, in the first week of April. But we are starting to see a lot of new developments in the Star Wars universe. And one of the big news was actually the release of the trailer to Ahsoka, which we actually have a teaser of what this series will bring to the world of the Star Wars.
Something's coming. Something dark.
Looks pretty groovy. It's a two-minute trailer. We were only showing you just a little snippet of what's to come. But, you know, Rosario Dawson, I mean, I think she's a fabulous actress. I think she's going to absolutely kill it in the scene. I know when we first saw her, right, you know, in The Mandalorian Season 2, there's so much promise. And then she shows up in the Book of Boba Fett. So we'll see what's good. But
Boba Fett.
Yeah. Chris tends to like to butcher things a lot. Actually, there is a return of an iconic figure that will be making its way back to the cinematic screen. That is correct. That is Daisy Ridley. That is Rey. She is going to be coming back to rebuild the Jedi Order. And what's kind of wild about this, Marissa, is, but hey, we want to let everybody know we got an amazing show for everybody that's tuning into the Chris Collins Show Millennial Talk Show. And joining us on Just Talking is that one Catholic girl, Vanessa Forsblad. She is an amazing soul. We're going to be talking about all things religion and Good Friday, as well as Strike a Chord guest, music producer, Steve Ornest. Oh my gosh, this is going to be legendary, fam. And also check out my music podcast series, Off the Fret, more music talk, featuring Nashville country star Amanda Cooksey as our eighth installment. But all right, listeners, it is time to rock and roll. What's good, listeners? Welcome to Good Friday. Joining us on Just Talking is Vanessa Forsblad, known as That One Catholic Girl, live on the Chris Collins Show, Millennial Talk Show. How's it going, fam?
Hi, I'm doing awesome. How are you guys this morning?
We're wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Very excited.
Yes, absolutely. And Vanessa, talk to us about why you got your channel started, That One Catholic Girl.
Yes, of course. So I started my channel, I think, at the age of 18 years old. And so I wasn't very much of a practicing Christian for like basically my entire life. I went through my sacraments, but I didn't really know why I was there other than the fact that my parents made me go. It wasn't until I turned 18 did I have this like revelation that I wanted to start teaching about the faith, and I fell in love with studying it. I fall in love with teaching it. And honestly, if we're going to tell all my secrets, it was really because I wanted to try to convert the boyfriend I was with at the time. But that didn't end up working out. But I ended up getting left with a beautiful channel. And I've been doing it for about 5 years now. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and so you said at like 18 years old is when you started to first become interested in your faith, even though you had parents that raised you in the Catholic faith.
Yes, exactly. So I went through my sacraments. I went through like my confirmation classes, which I teach confirmation right now. So I'm seeing what my students are like, how they respond to my teachings. I'm like, I was just like you. Just wait, maybe till you turn 18. Maybe you'll have a Catholic YouTube channel. We don't know. But I fell in love with studying the faith at 18, and I love to talk. And so I was trying to figure out what do I want to talk about for the rest of my life. And I chose the Catholic faith.
Are you going to go into like possibly being a nun later on? I mean, that's no. Okay. I was like, how much are you really going to commit?
I don't think I'll be a nun because I wanna have a family and kids one day. But right now, I'm actually going for my master's in theology.
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you. I studied communications at Cal State LA, and I got my bachelor's. That was the year 2020. And so the year 2020 had a lot of time to decide where I wanted to go. And so 2 years later, I decided to start studying at a seminary. So all of my classmates are priests and nuns. So it's interesting when I address them on our forums online, I'm like, dear father, dear sister. And it's very interesting for me. But yeah, it's exciting stuff.
Well, clearly it sounds like faith has influenced your daily life and your decision making. I mean, you kind of started off the top of this segment as saying, you know, I had this ex-boyfriend that I was trying to convert to the Catholic faith, but he just wouldn't jive with it. So when you were speaking about this new revelation that you found at an early adulthood, what is it that you seek in this post-life that we call adulthood?
You know, I think my direction is a little different than a lot of people my age. I am 25, and I've decided that what I want to focus on and what I want to make a career out of is teaching about the faith online and hopefully one day in Catholic media, like on Catholic radio or Catholic TV. But what I found so important in my life is that just having a foundation of just having structure, tradition, values have really like set forth my life in a positive way. And so I like to teach my viewers about it, my students about it, because I just see the beauty of having something like that in your life.
And you know, I think it's really great that you, you know, jump on this, because as you know, I grew up in a Christian faith in that sense, but I find myself more spiritual than I would say a Christian. Like, I believe in God. I do not go to church. I don't, you know, don't have that, but I have a daughter. And it's been one of those things that I had to sit and think about is I want her raised with tradition, values, a moral compass, right? And how do I, and I struggle with how do I find that within my community? And one of the things that I personally found was Episcopalian church, because I do have, I have a problem with the tenet of like homosexuality is evil, right? I have a problem with that. I don't want my daughter raised in that. But if I want her raised in a Christian background, in a faith, like I had to do a lot of research. I found something that aligned with my values for her. And I have slacked on it, I have to admit. I don't go like I need to. And I do feel like that's lacking in my daughter, is having this foundation that you talk about.
But Marissa, I think there is something that you are getting onto, because, you know, I was raised in the Mormon church for 18 years. And, you know, and I definitely respect all the values that I've learned from the teachings of, you know, the LDS, you know, that spirituality in that world. But, you know, I'm kind of someone, and I feel like the rest of the millennials and Gen Z feel the same way. We kind of have like zero pleasure in talking about religion. And why do you think that is the main reason today? I mean, why are people so reluctant to talk about their beliefs?
You know, I think that there may have been a slight overcorrection where that the church, or just like Christianity as a whole, or any religion, seemed like it was being too abrasive and pushing its values or its beliefs on other people. And so now I see almost this like overcorrection of saying that we should just throw out all authority as a whole. And so I see that like being done when I'm talking to people, like, oh, I don't want to answer to anyone. But I see having that structure, answering to authority, as a positive thing. I mean, we have teachers, we have parents, we have presidents. So we have people that we look up to who have authoritative positions. And so there seems to be like a negative talking about Christianity. But the thing is that, or at least I'm going to speak about Christianity because I am a Christian. But one of the main teachings is that to love one another as you would love yourself. And so I think that that kind of got like taken away throughout the years in the past. I feel like they're being too abrasive, maybe being too defensive. And so now we see this like overcorrection. But really, the root of it all is to love one another as yourself. And so you wouldn't go towards anyone with hatred, even if they have different beliefs than you do. You would spend time within instruction with them. And I didn't see that happening maybe early on in the church or throughout these past like 100 years.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say, though, in the year 2023, we're more connected than ever? I mean, we do have the technology and social media unlike anything that we've seen, let's say, 200 years ago. So why is there, like, this disconnect? It seems like there's more anxiety and depression and mental health being discussed more and more every day. Do you think that has to do with the lack of spirituality found in younger generations?
I think so. I think that everything like has like a cause, like a root of it all. And so I see right now, because I'm in like the Christian social media circle, I see this like huge growth of the youth moving towards, you know, more of a spiritual religion or having Christianity in their life and having it as a part of it versus when I was younger. I didn't really see that, but that was when like social media was just starting up. So I don't know. Sometimes I get a little bit concerned that maybe it's a fad to be on social media and like to be like, oh, I'm a Christian talking about the end times, or if I actually genuinely am teaching. But overall, I think it's just nice to have kids come back to the faith or have them talking about values or traditions, you know, instead of just having a free for all.
Yeah. And I like that you said that you are noticing a resurgence in spirituality, because I came across an article, and we were talking about this week, where even though there is a decline in millennials overall, and I know Chris will go into that, but in this last year, just this last year alone, there has been a spike in Gen Z and millennials wanting spirituality in their life and actively attending church and actively reaching out in communities and doing that. And that there's action just in this last year. And so I've seen it within my own friends. I have a lot of friends that, you know, went from being very either atheist or an agnostic in there to full-blown Christian, having Bible study in their house because of their children. I mean, a lot of my friends are older. We have kids. So a lot of are like, okay, that was cool for me. But then I did a lot of drugs. I've done a lot of, you know, things I'm not proud of in my life. I put myself in sexual harm, right? All this stuff. And I don't want my daughter to have that. I don't want my daughter to be depressed.
But I do think, Marissa, you are bringing up a very fascinating point, because, you know, you do want to raise your child in a household that has some kind of religious ties. And as you see with this chart, most Gen Zers today do not believe it's necessary to raise children in a religion. So when you see these charts and you see the slight decline over previous generations, what do you, how do you analyze this?
See, I don't know who they studied in that case study, because maybe it's just my circle. Maybe I'm just, my TikTok feed is just all Christianity, so maybe that's why. But I do see this extreme resurgence, and it's almost like the pendulum has swung back. You know, like maybe people have like lost this sense of structure, and now they want the structure back. When I talk to my students in my classes, I do hear this like need for structure or authority. They may not want me to tell them exactly what they want to do, but I do see this need from them that they want someone to tell them what's right and what's wrong, or at least allow them, provide them with some guidance instead of saying, do whatever you want. That's how I'm seeing it.
And I can see it like as a guidance, because I think that when, at least, and I'll speak for myself, when I'm at my lowest, when I'm at my most depressed, my most darkest moment, like I do pray. I mean, I do have something that I will turn to, because I don't have a network necessarily that I can fall into, that I can just call on a whim or whatever. And sometimes I need that spiritual. I found myself becoming more spiritual as I've gotten older. You know, had it younger, questioned a lot of it. I still question. Don't get me wrong. Well, I still question.
But no, I think you're getting more. You're getting to a good point, Marissa, because I think there is a chart that kind of backs all that, you know, saying that, you know, more than a third of the Gen Z identifies as religiously unaffiliated. And I kind of feel like this is just my personal thought process on when I think about this. I think they just don't know where to begin. I mean, doesn't it feel intimidating to walk into like any kind of church when you think about it? But what I think is a beautiful thing, and sort of what I believe Marissa's trying to get at, is in the month of February, the Asbury Revival was something quite remarkable that we haven't seen since, I believe, 2004, 2006. And for anybody who hasn't seen the clips of what went down, we actually have it for you guys. So let's go ahead and take a look.
People lined up for blocks.
We know the name, Jesus.
so the reason why I wanted to showcase this clip, Vanessa, is like Marissa was sort of hinting at it. It's like, you know, like I truly believe I don't have to go to church every Sunday to prove that I'm one with God. I might have been a little biased back then when I was under the age of 18. I used to hate missing NFL Sundays. You know, so like nowadays, I kind of feel like the youth is sort of choosing when they want to go out and go to these kind of gatherings. And why do you see, do you feel like religion's becoming more of like a personal matter, or do you think it's becoming a little bit more openly and freely?
You know, I think that we need to instruct better and that like provide resources so that people can understand what each church offers or the importance of going to places, because I didn't know why it was important to go to mass on Sunday or why it was important for me to practice my faith or read scripture. But I do see this like resurgence of wanting to connect the community. And that is because I'm a Catholic Christian. I believe that the church isn't just like a personal relationship with Christ, but it's a community as a whole. We see it like talked about in scripture. That's not just like one person meeting with God, but it's supposed to be a community. And I think because we like went through the world shutting down where we weren't really having that community and we weren't really having anyone like to talk to, or at least like in person, about the values that we have and the things that we feel like represent us. And so I see this resurgence about people wanting this like community of like-minded individuals who just want to love one another and welcome people in. And so I really think it's important for all churches to understand that not everyone understands their faith. And so it's our job as whatever church that we're a part of to represent our faith and teach about our faith. And that's what I'm trying to do on the internet. When I first started my Catholic YouTube channel, I was defensive. I was kind of being abrasive, saying I'm right and you're wrong. But as I've grown throughout the years, I recognize that, you know what, people just genuinely have questions, and I should be in the position to want to answer those questions with love, charity, and humility. And I think that's what's happening in this resurgence of wanting community in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think you nailed it. I mean, there's a reason why this revival went viral on TikTok. It garnished millions of views online, and it literally had its own certified hashtag. And there's a reason why 50,000 students and visitors had come to the campus to pray, which I think is a beautiful thing. And do you believe that, you know, like traditional worship services are still relevant, you know, to younger generations? Or do you see things becoming a bit different moving forward? Do you see it becoming more of like a digital showcase?
You know, I'm really seeing it go in the digital realm. And I don't see it as a negative thing, because God is the same today, yesterday, and tomorrow. So I believe that he's omnipotent, he's omnipresent. So he's always there and he always knows. So he knew that there was going to be internet. And so because of the beginning of COVID, they started offering church services online where you could watch it on live stream. Now, I believe that I want to go to my parish to like receive the Eucharist, because I'm a Catholic and that's important. But I see other churches like offering these live streams or offering, you know, just videos on the internet. And I see it as a beautiful thing, because someone could say that, oh, the internet or using social media is like making it turn or like making it like devaluing it, but it's spreading God or spreading your faith to masses of people. And I think that's a wonderful and beautiful thing. I see only positives coming from it.
And why do you think it went viral in the first place, these revivals? Because it's happened before in the past, you know, why now?
I really think it's this like want of community and feeling like I feel like there was a time where people didn't feel like they were welcome to say their values or their viewpoints, because the world was so divided on so many different things. And so I feel like some people, just to avoid confrontation, didn't want to say what they believed or say what they think. And so seeing other people believe the same things as them or something similar really started a fire in their hearts and made it seem like it's okay for me to talk about what I believe or my values. And so I think that's why that there was this huge thing on the internet of a bunch of people like agreeing and meeting together to talk about their beliefs.
Well, we actually saw this morning the University of Albany had a guest speaker who his political spectrum was conservative, and we saw the smashing of a Bible, people literally trying to toss this guy out of the university for speaking. Do you think these revivals are a way to fight back against those who are attacking religion?
Could you restate the question?
Where are we?
It's, you know, because sometimes I view these kind of revivals and people coming together as like we're seeing more violence in the streets, more people being attacked for who they are, what they believe in. I mean, it's not just at, you know, at Catholic schools. I mean, we've seen since May 2020, there have been nearly 300 attacks against U.S. Catholic churches. And according to a tracker from the Catholic Vote, last August, The Atlantic also published an article declaring that the Catholic Rosary had become a symbol of, you know, religious radicalism. So, you know, the reason why I'm kind of bringing this up is, do you feel like these revivals are a way to fight back against those in the media or those who have a voice on social media attacking those who practice faith in religion?
I think so. I think that we respond to like what we receive. And so I think that there was a certain time where there was a lot of negativity towards the Catholic faith. I mean, it's the Catholic faith has been around for 2000 years. So it's like nothing new under the sun. But I think now everyone has a platform to voice their opinion. And I always find this interesting. I talk about this with my parents. Like we see, for instance, actors and actresses, they used to be like the elite. The people that we would look for, like look to, and like in awe. But now we're looking at TikTokers who, like, are 20 years old, and we're in awe of them, and they have greater followers. And so it's kind of interesting how the internet and social media has allowed for each and every person to have a platform and have a voice that's almost equal to everyone else's. And so I do see these like revivals happening, or these like things on social media of people talking about their faith as a way of combating the negativity that may be brought towards the church. But like I said, this has been done like for many, many years. Like for instance, we see Satanists, they'll have the cross upside down and they'll have that as their symbol. But it was actually St. Peter who was crucified upside down because he didn't feel like he was worthy of being crucified in the same manner as Christ. So sometimes people will take things about the faith or take things about any like religion or values, and they'll try to flip it on its head and make it their own. But now that everyone has a platform, which is a beautiful thing, they could come out and say their beliefs and combat some negativity or misinformation.
Yeah, I think you raised such a beautiful point. I think that is so true. I know with the Asbury revival, just that one particular example, they kept saying, we don't want celebrities to show up. We don't even want news organizations. The beauty about this whole revival is people are just coming because of the word of God, you know, technology, social media, and etc. I think that is such a cool thing. And since we got a few minutes with you, I know that there was something really fun that you like to do as a side thing that has actually been blowing up. You have like two different channels. Obviously, you do That One Catholic Girl, but you also do burrito reviews, yes, which I kind of thought was pretty cool. Why this? I mean, you do it with your 93-year-old grandma?
Yeah, I do. I don't know where it actually started. I'm not a picky eater. Like, there's nothing that, like, if I go to a burger place, I get everything. Tomato, onions, I get everything. So I'm not a picky eater whatsoever. But randomly one day, I was just like, I should start a bean and cheese burrito review page. And it randomly, like, took off because apparently people like bean and cheese burritos, which I wasn't aware of. And so I invited my grandmother to start reviewing them with me. And she thought I was like crazy and insane because she's like, you're going to go to a restaurant and you're going to order a bean and cheese burrito. But quickly she caught on, fell in love with it. And it's been a way of me just documenting our relationship with each other, and people seem to like it on the internet.
Oh yeah, it's really cool. We actually got a clip because you did a recap because you've done over 100+ reviews now, which I think is super cool. Yes. So let's go ahead and showcase what you can expect from the burrito reviews.
I don't think you guys are ready for this. We have officially eaten 100 bean and cheese burritos on our series of looking for the best bean and cheese burrito out there. And today I'm revealing my top 5 bean and cheese burritos. Coming in 5th, we have El Tapayac, number 1. In 4th place, we have Tacos Baja. 3rd place, we have El Palon Meat Market and Restaurant. 2nd place, we have Taqueria El Tapatio. And coming in 1st place, we have Las Comadres. I want to thank you guys all so much for coming on this journey with us. What should we do next?
I don't think you guys are ready for this. Oh, we have officially eaten 100 bean and cheese
burritos. Don't do it again. I want to speak with Vanessa. I mean, this might sound like really, really random, but like, obviously, you've eaten over 100, you know, bean and cheese burritos. Is it start with the beans? Is it the cheese factor? I mean, what is it? I mean, is it them trying to put their own like homemade sauce into the mix that like could really go, nah, that ain't it?
Well, if you saw at the end, I have this thing referencing a Google Doc I have, which has like over 100 pages. And I break down every part of the burrito into different categories. And I give them each a score, and then I get the average score. So I rank it on tortilla, beans, cheese, and size to price ratio. Like, is it really worth the price that they put it at? But honestly, there's some places where the tortilla and the cheese are amazing and the beans are not. There's some places where the...
It was on one of your reviews. It was in Whittier, and you were, and I'm telling you, you're like tortilla bomb, cheese to bean ratio bomb, but the beans kind of flavors, literally same thing. I had it. And I was like, yep, those beans. There's no flavor in it. There's no love. I don't know what was going on. Love the cheese. Love the tortilla. It was. But I have to say, I appreciated your honesty with it because it was spot on. I did try it, and you had a spot on review.
And what county really kind of throws it down in Southern California?
Oh, so I really like the OC, but if I'm going to be honest, I know you asked for Southern California, but Las Vegas makes like awesome Mexican food. So I'm
really?
Actually heading.
Because there's not too many cats that reference Las Vegas out of all places. It's usually like the Texas scene or California.
I don't know why it's so good, but like my best bean and cheese burritos are in Las Vegas, except my number one is in La Mirada, which I found out is LA County, but I still consider OC because it's like borderline. But yeah, Las Vegas has really good bean and cheese burritos.
Okay, well, you heard it first. I mean, I actually want to stay away far as possible from Sin City, but maybe you're giving me a tiny reason why I would want to come back. But yes, Vanessa, you have been such an amazing soul with us on the Chris Collins Show, Millennial Talk Show. And for everybody that wants to follow both of your channels, go ahead and check out That One Catholic Girl and on TikTok at Burrito Review. So Vanessa Forsblad, it's been awesome talking with you on this Good Friday.
You're wonderful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Absolutely, Vanessa. And have a beautiful rest of your Easter Sunday this weekend.
Thank you.
For everybody that's tuning in right now to the Chris Collins Show, Millennial Talk Show, stick around as we have more left on the show. What's good, listeners? Our guest on Strike a Chord is music producer Steve Ornest, the man currently behind Southern California's legendary Total Access Recording Studios. How's it going, fam?
I'm good. What's happening, guys?
Oh, everything
hello.
Louis Vuitton, Tom Ford, Gucci. Hopefully everything's good in your world, man.
It's all good.
I like
over
your
here.
Studio. That is a nice little setup you're sitting in there.
Oh, thank you. It's actually fake. It's just a background.
It's just, you know, it's just background stuff.
So you're in the AI.
Yeah, exactly. It's all AI.
Oh, gotcha. Because I was going to say that you're burning like an Essence Sticks right about now. But no Essence Sticks being burned. No, man, you're not doing no fragrance lamp in there. You're not trying to set the tone for any artist.
Not yet.
I feel like you do need one of those like little lava lamps in the background.
If I move the computer screen, you'd see that I have a couple. Yeah.
Really?
You nailed it.
Yeah.
They're by the keyboards because that's what keyboard players love. Mm-hmm. You have to have lava.
Yeah, to get a little lava.
Okay, that's funny because I thought, you know, usually someone that's like a music producer like yourself, Steve, you're probably going like, oh my gosh, less noise inside this recording space would be great. I thought lava lamps made noise.
Well, they're not quite lava lamps. I think they're like, I don't know what you call them, but there's some sort of like lamp device.
It's like the oil thing. They're like,
yeah,
they do this.
Exactly.
Yeah, he knew what I was talking about. We worked together.
Oh, okay. It sounds like because both of y'all are like the millennial soccer parents. That's the kind of vibes that you guys are giving me right about now.
I think I dropped acid watching those go. Like, wow.
I have to figure out how to dumb it down after the last conversation you guys have, because I'm just the music guy. I'm not smart enough for any of that.
I think we all need a little shift of gears. That was a very beautiful, intense conversation, and we are ready to continue forward, right?
Absolutely. And Steve, let's talk about you, because you had an incredible upbringing as a child, learning piano and guitar at an early age. But what happened when you started playing your Gibson Les Paul in the bleachers in high school?
Very good. Very good question. So I was the kind of kid that would come to school with the Gibson Les Paul and had long hair and was wearing leather pants. I'll give you the full description. Leather pants, the Gibson Les Paul, cutting class, playing guitar in the bleachers. And this girl came up to me and said, "Hey, you're really good. You should meet my dad." And I said, "Well, who's your dad?" And she said, "Wynn Davis." And so I went home and went on the family computer, because that's how old I am. We had one computer in the house, and typed his name in and thought, "Oh my God, this guy's done all these amazing records." And so I went back to school the next day and, of course, was like, "Yes, like, please invite your dad to my next show." And to my surprise, he actually showed up and was sitting there. And I remember being just terrified the whole time. Wow. I'm like, this guy's recorded my favorite guitar players, you know?
Well, especially when you're probably playing That's in awesome. Like half empty room. And then all of a sudden the one guy that does show up that you do invite
is Gandalf.
All focus on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So are you starting to sweat reliving these memories?
Oh man, it's pouring off me right now. But he was super cool. And after the show, he's like, "Steve, you should come to the studio sometime," which I did. And he took me under his wing, and we started this work relationship where he would call me and have me play on records he was working on. And I started kind of assisting around the studio. I was only like 15 years old at the time, or 14. And yeah, the sort of storybook part of this is that my mom was the one dropping me off, of course, because I couldn't drive yet. She met Wynn, they fell in love, they got married. So Wynn becomes my dad. And fast forward all these years.
Wait, back this up.
Yes.
They fall in love and get married. But didn't you say, did you have a crush on his daughter that introduced you?
No.
Oh, okay. I was about to say that. I'm about to get real freaky real quick.
Jerry.
Exactly. I love my Jerry Springer. I always go there.
That would definitely be pretty wild.
That'd be weird.
But wild.
Yeah, I'm just not that interesting.
But your mom obviously is.
Yeah, she's the interesting one. But I do have everything to thank to Tenley for introducing me to her amazing dad, who I now consider my dad. And again, fast forward all these years later, and I run the studio now with Wynn. And it's been a crazy, crazy journey. I actually never thought that I'd be doing this. I always thought it was just going to be playing guitar for artists, which I did for many years. And then sort of just like a magnet found my way back to the studio. So
no, I think that is such a cool thing, because I know even after high school, you know, you pursued a degree at the Berklee College of Music on scholarship. And what did you discover about yourself attending this university?
Man, the crazy thing about a place like Berklee is that everyone is the hero in their own zip code. So everyone is incredibly talented. You're not really special anymore. You're just like stand in line behind the other amazing guitar player that can play what you just did, but better and cleaner and faster, you know? So I remember turning in assignments, and like in an arranging class I was in, and one of the teachers was like, "Hey, what studio did you record this in?" And of course, like, I had brought with me all of my recording equipment, and I was living in an attic at the time, so I could make as like loud and as late into the evening as I wanted to. But that sort of made me recognize that, I guess, the idea that I could record and arrange songs and produce was actually special and set me apart more than just being a guitar player, you know?
So you felt like that was a valuable asset in your musical career to actually go to school to learn music production? Because again, you were 15 years old when you had the opportunity to work with Wynn Davis, and some of the early stories that I was reading about you, Steve, was that one of your first outings was actually being in the room with Zakk Wylde from Black Label Society, you know, also the guitarist for Ozzy Osbourne. So I would think, you know, with that kind of, you know, experience, you know, some cats would go, Why now? Why college for, you know, this kind of place that you're in?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, admittedly, I actually dropped out of high school when I was a junior to just do this full time and tour with bands, and then later wound up going back and getting my certificate. But Wynn was actually the one that was sort of the biggest proponent for me to go, because he's like, look, it's awesome that you're in these circles, but you could always come back to this. My only fear for you is that you're 15, 16 years old. You're playing with guys that are all in their 40s and you're a part of, you know, and I just want to give you the opportunity to be around people that are your age that are pushing for the same thing that you are. And again, I wasn't trying to be a recording engineer or a producer then. I just thought I'm going to play guitar, and very specific, I'm going to play hard rock and metal guitar forever.
Hell
and
yeah.
Thankfully, one of the cool things about going to a place like Berklee is that you get immersed mm-hmm. in styles and sounds that you never would have. If I would have stayed here, I'd be talking to you right now, and I'd probably have super long hair, and I'd still
and you're
be
gonna
wearing
be playing bluegrass and Amish country. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I know, bluegrass right? and Amish.
You'd probably have a much smaller bank account.
I wouldn't be married, and I wouldn't. Yeah. yeah.
But Steve, it's my understanding that as a music producer, your work schedule kind of consists of like 60 to 80 hours, sometimes 6 to 7 days a week. So why is that? I mean, is there like no guaranteed salary within music production?
No, I mean, there is no guaranteed salary. And a lot, you know, things in this field just take a long time. It's not the best way to describe is that if you're working on a song or a project, sometimes it could take 100 hours or more on one song, you know. And I think a lot of people imagine being in the recording studio is like the band comes in, they record their song in a few hours and they leave. But there are hours, you know, sometimes 20 hours of pre-production before even coming in the studio, where I'll be involved with the band and making sure that the song arrangement is the best that it can be. And then when we come into the studio, there's experimenting, there's making sure, you know, that everything is sounding the way that we want it to. There's tone chasing, there's getting the right performance, because it's not just about making it sound good. It's about making you feel something, and capturing lightning in a bottle can take time. You know,
but you just did reference, you know, sometimes it takes 20 to 100 hours to work, you know, on a single track, correct? Is that what
sure.
you're saying? Okay.
Yep.
So with that being said, how do you set the tone with new artists? Because I was reading a lot of things about you online, and you do have pet peeves when it comes to artists.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Oh, I need to hear. Do it.
One of the pet peeves that you had online was when an artist comes to you in the studio and they bring up an idea with you, but they go, hey, listen, look, I want to sound like Billie Eilish. I love this sound. And why do you have a problem when artists come to you and say, I want to sound just like Billie Eilish. I want to sound exactly like Madonna. I want to sound exactly like a Hot Mulligan right now in the pop punk scene.
Totally. So, and I feel bad because I use Billie Eilish as a reference all the time. And the only reason is
because she's so popular. She's mainstream.
Yeah. Especially, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when she was first starting to break, I would get a lot of young artists that would come in and with a song, and the song would be really good. And it sounded like something entirely different from Billie Eilish. So I would hear it ahead of time, and I'd go into this meeting thinking, God, I have so many ideas for what we can do with this, make it the best song it is. And instead of having a conversation about how that particular artist can fulfill their potential as being their own wonderful artist, their own self, they're trying to chase what Billie Eilish is already doing. And the problem is, if we go down that path, by the time that we do it, Billie Eilish won't be doing that anymore. So what you're doing is probably not going to be cool.
Yeah.
And then in a couple of years, you're going to hate it. And you're going to be like, why did we ever do this? So I just believe that the best chance you really have is to just do you, you know, and let's just make the best version of what you're already doing, as opposed to change. And it's, of course, it's good to have references and it's good to have what you're influenced by, but that's entirely different than being like, okay, but listen to the snare sound from this song and the kick drum from that song and the vocal delay from, and I'm like, what are we even doing? Like, no one listens to music that way.
Well, clearly you as a music producer, you have to go through these unique challenges. And how do you handle the mistakes and imperfections that come with producing an LP?
The imperfections. Sorry, can you reframe that?
Well, like, let's say, for example, you know, there's some artists or I've heard that like come in super prepared going into the studio. Also, there are artists who like to leave some wiggle room to get inside the studio to explore new things. And then there are artists that haven't quite nailed exactly what they want to do, and they bring in all their rough tentacles into the mix. And so you, as the music producer, how do you weed out all those flaws?
Sure. So it's really interesting. Like you said, there are some artists that I work with that have done a tremendous amount of pre-production at home, especially with today's technology and the ability to record a lot at home. So I'll get demos that are like fully fledged, and there's amazing pros and some cons in that. The pros, of course, is that the band is probably really prepared to execute what they've prepared. The cons is that they have demoitis and they love probably a lot of what they've already done, even if there are flaws with their arrangement or things that I feel like could be better and could make the song better. So I just try to always sort of lean into the fact that this for me is not about ego or about, like, I'm open to any ideas that you guys have. But all I really care about at the end of the day is just making this the best that it can be. So let's just try some things, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's usually how I go about that way. And yeah, it just depends band to band. Some are really cool about it and some struggle and some don't want to do it. And sometimes you have to kind of arm wrestle over it. And, you know, it's
do you get to pick, do you get to pick who you want to work with? I take it by now, or are you kind of one of those persons that is paid to work with somebody? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that I am fortunate to get to choose a lot of the work that comes in based on, and a lot of times it has nothing to do with like previous success or what their financial situation is. It's based on, is this something that I want to get behind and put those hours into, because I know myself and I'll work on it until I'm blue in the face, until my wife's like, why are you still at the studio? You know,
she's like, come home. You do have a wife. Exactly. Remember me.
I know. She's amazing. So yeah.
Steve, I remember in a interview on the Howard Stern show with the Imagine Dragons singer, he was talking about how before he became who he is today, he was a music producer and a ghostwriter to a lot of our favorite artists, but he wouldn't dispel who they were. With that being said, have you been asked by artists who come into your studio to actually write musical arrangements that you actually created, but they didn't?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so here's my take on it, though, is like I feel like people get too precious about doing everything themselves. And the reality is that this business is always a team effort, whether it's, you know, like this, it's a, you know, if you're an artist, you're building a brand. Like if you're McDonald's, you have a brand and you have a menu and you have staff and you have something that works about what you're doing that you can, you know, and it's this, if you're trying to do this for real and you're trying to be professional, you have an agent, you have a manager, you have PR, you have the label, you have producers, you have writers that sometimes help. I don't think that makes you less of an artist or less of a person. It's just people that are contributing to your brand and making it, you know. Just
but how
you.
Often does that occur, though, Steve? I think that's like the real question. How often does the music producer give in his own musical taste into some of our favorite hip hop, rock and roll, country acts?
I mean, all the time, you know, like, yeah, I mean, there and varying degrees, of course, but like I play a bunch of different instruments and I sing and I do all these things. So a lot of times when I'll be working with an artist, I'll have an idea of maybe it's an arrangement thing. Maybe it's changing a lyric. Maybe it's a melody thing. Maybe I'm just going to play a bunch of stuff. And it's again, it's not about ego. It's just about how can we shape the sound of this to like benefit the artist and chase the vision that they have. And if I feel like I can contribute to that, then I'm going to go for it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And how often do you follow like the latest like music trends and technology? I mean, and how do you like incorporate them into your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always listening to what's going on out there. And some of it I really love and some of it I just don't enjoy. But I think it's always good to just have taste, your own taste, and know kind of, it's really all this is, I mean, all we have is the taste that's in our own mouths anyway. There is no recipe for success, which frustrates a lot of bands because you'll have some sort of success and then a band comes in expecting or hoping the same. Can you do what you did for those guys? And I'm like, but those guys are those guys, you know? I was only a small part of that. But as far as the technology part goes, I mean, I'm, you know, our studio.
I guess the reason why I'm bringing up the whole technology thing is, I mean, Marissa and I, we talked about it like a month ago. I also do a side show called Rage Quit Video Game Talk Show with one of our CCS video game contributors, Henrik the Wreck. And we've been talking about all this like AI technology that's been coming up, like GPT-4. Ubisoft came up with their own thing called Ghost Rider, which is going to be actually producing dialogue faster for video games in the future. And I also know that Google has an AI out right now, which is trying to produce music faster, lyrical and musically. So when you start seeing these kind of things, are you skeptical about the position that you're in as a music producer? Or do you think that you'll just enhance these tools for, you know, your tools?
Yeah, no, I'm not really worried about that. I mean, I'd say that with AI in general, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm always afraid that people are going to mess it up because that's just what we seem
to
like
do. Humans are. We're just going to shit where we are. It's just going to happen.
Social media is an amazing idea. And then, of course, we just ruin it.
And then humans get involved. It's like every sci-fi book I've ever read was like, it was a great idea. And then came the humans.
Yeah, I think we could all recognize that, like, you know, obviously the cameras have gotten so much better on iPhones, you know, just like how the microphones can be. So yeah, you could probably travel on the go a lot faster, but it kind of sounds like you're not as you don't think this is going to be as fulfilling in the long term.
I just believe that a great song is and what goes into making like the hair stand up on your arms is not something hopefully anytime in my lifetime an AI can do.
Yeah, it's human aspect. An AI will only ever go so far, and it's going to miss the one thing that makes that an AI, which is the human aspect. We are unpredictable. There is a feeling. I think what you said, you wanted the song to make a feeling. It wasn't how it sounded, but how I feel when I listen to it. And an AI can never get that.
Yeah,
that's what humans aren't going to go anywhere without it.
Yeah,
it's so true.
Yeah, the recording technology is incredible where it's gone. The things we can do now, I'm sure artists 50 years ago wish they had this. However, when I listen to the Beatles, I'm not thinking about the recording quality. I'm not worrying about if only they had better converters. You know, like no one cares. Like they're just
that's
this
a good point.
Great.
Oh, those damn
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds would have sounded so good with my stuff.
The thing with AI that for me, I mean, and again, I'm probably the worst person to talk about this because I know the least, but what seems exciting is maybe in the medical world, like the idea of a computer.
That's a good point.
I'm all for AI. Just so you know, I love AI. I'm all for it. We might die. The AI might kill us. We might be the end of humanity. Yeah. But I am all for it.
There you go, Marissa. Yeah. But Steve, you know, it's been awesome to have you on Striking Chord, brother. And can you share any kind of upcoming projects or collaborations that you got in the works?
Yeah, there's a bunch of exciting stuff that's going on over here. And one of the things I was going to just mention is that I feel like there's a shift happening right now in music that I'm hearing. And what it is with a lot of younger bands is it's almost like a combination of like 90s grunge and punk rock, but like a modern spin on it. And there's a lot of newer bands. And the way I know that this is more than just what's coming into the studio and an actual movement is I'm seeing bands getting signed and stuff that's starting to get played on the radio. And it's exciting for me because I'm hearing a lot of guitar again and a lot of organic instruments, in modern music. I'm working with this band right now called Will Awake. We did a song that actually got them on K-Rock, and we're going back in this summer, and I'm co-producing it with Jacob Armstrong, who is the son of Billy Joe Armstrong.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
I was gonna say, I know that name. Okay.
Yeah, so super excited about that. They're awesome, man. They're just such a great young rock band.
That's cool.
So,
man, we'll
definitely try to get them on.
Scoping them out. And absolutely, man. Well, Steve Ornes, it's been awesome having you on Strike a Chord, brother. And thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
So wonderful.
Thanks, Marissa. Appreciate
you. Thanks, Steve.
All right, this is what's good because we want to set the tone going into the weekend because, after all, this is Good Friday. And the Ocean Cleanup, the only organization currently tackling the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, has just reached a milestone of 220 tons of plastic removed from the ocean, which is so freaking incredible. We also got a clip of how that works.
That's quite some plastic, guys. I hope we'll break the 200 tons in this one.
We will.
Pretty confident.
But yeah, it was over 220 tons, which is so freaking remarkable. I would like to see in our own country, which I think is very, very cool. So again, this is the only organization doing something about tackling plastic waste in the ocean. And believe it or not, it was actually started by a 28-year-old entrepreneur, which is very, very, very cool. But hey, also, we want to give a huge shout out again to our amazing guest that joined us for this jam-packed show. That is our Just Talking guest, which is Vanessa Forsblad. She is That One Catholic Girl. You can go ahead and check out her YouTube channel, as well as her viral TikTok burrito review, at burrito review. Literally, if you know how to spell burrito, you're going to be able to find Vanessa. Also, our Strike a Chord guest, which is music producer Steve Ornest. He's got a lot of amazing work, obviously cooking up, that he just hinted with us on Strike a Chord, which is very, very cool. And I also want to let you guys know that I got an Off the Fret More Music Talk podcast featuring Nashville country star Amanda Cooksey, out now on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, join me every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time with my co-host, Henrik the Wreck, as we talk about video game news, industry talk, viral meltdowns, and so much more. It's been so much fun, only 6 episodes in, and we ain't stopping anytime soon. And if you like what you're listening to, go to thechriscollegeshow.com, become a member today, and get that free CCS t-shirt. For now, enjoy the weekend, fam, and we'll see you next week. Peace. What's good? It's Chris from The Chris Collins Show, Millennial Talk Show, featuring Nashville singer-songwriter Amanda Cooksey, known for her breakup songs, crop tops, and TikTok covers, is a refreshing new voice in country music. Joins Off the Fret. More music talk. What's good, party people? Chris Collins Show presents Music Storm 2022, hosted by Chris Collins and Marissa Pitts, featuring Royals, There's got to be a better way. Hurricane Highway, Cannibal Kids, Amanda Cooksey, Astoria State, Kid Dad, Resounding, Sleep Cycles, Avenues, Freckles, Weather Worn, Just True, Sophia Marie. Music Storm 2022. Available wherever you listen to podcasts. Our brand new podcast, Off the Fret.
I love it. It's more time to chat.
Hello.
You would look so jazzy.
I love your outfit.
How far would you go to start playing live music again?
This slaps harder than my ex when she got her stimulus check. So, are you here to bring the sexual healing with your music? Called Everything is Everything, and I guarantee you're going to hear this song in the future. I love the flow, man. Politically charged album. So, if you get easily offended, this might not be the album for you. Brand new podcast, Off the Fret.
So excited.
Has Kim Kardashian accidentally sent you a coochie shot?
Do you want to stay there? It's completely your choice. Or you want to...
I feel you. And you know what? I love it. Off the Fret. More music talk. Peace.